This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Recall, if you will, the thrill of that first time you just buried your brother at Mario Kart. Or perhaps, if you're of a certain age, first time you beat the high score on Pac-Man at your local arcade. Gaming has come a long way since then, competitive gaming especially. It is gaining the legitimacy that it well deserves as a sport. Here to talk to us about the rise of esports around the globe and some new developments here in Michigan is Norris Howard. He's head of collegiate esports content at Beasley Media, and he's the host and producer of the podcast Checkpoint XP, coming to us from Detroit. Norris, welcome back to Stateside.
Hey, how's it going? Happy that we could talk about something super fun this time instead of doom and gloom.
Indeed. And also with us from Kalamazoo, Scott Schroeder. He's director of visualization at Perkins Will, sports architecture firm that helps their clients understand the esports scene. Scott, nice to hear your voice. Welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk about the world of esports and gaming.
We should probably start with definitions. Esports is just this umbrella term for various games that are out there. You know, the big ones that people know about, League of Legends and Overwatch, are very different than, say, your sports video games like Madden or NBA 2K. Scott, you came into sports architecture sort of through gaming. Will you tell us a little bit about how those two came together for you?
This all started back when I first started playing games. It was Duke Nukem 3D. And I got into using their level editor program, and I instantly loved it. And I knew I wanted to be in sort of the computer-generated creation world. So I went to Purdue University, and they had a program that not only did computer generation, but they also did it for architecture. And it mixed the two loves of my life. And so that's how I got into all of this and ended up at Perkins of Will, the Denver studio, which is the sports architecture firm. And esports came about, and it was just a perfect mix of the three things that I love to do now are all rolled into one.
Can you tell us a little bit about the kind of clients who've been interested in the work and just sort of what kinds of assurances and information they need from you?
We have had a healthy mix of both university clients and sort of the community rec clients, so installing an esports lab inside a community center. You know, some of the insurances that we try to give them is that it's a viable opportunity. Esports is definitely here to stay. It's only going to get much, much, much bigger. We try to help them understand their needs for networking, what types of computers, you know, they need to install, and understanding internet requirements and things like that. So that's what we really try to do. And we let them sort of make their own decisions on what games to install or what to do on that.
Norris, it feels like there was a period where esports was something that smaller schools were taking very seriously. But, you know, the University of Michigan, MSU, thought, well, you know, maybe we have enough draw for our student body that we don't need to take this as seriously. What do you think was the game changer? Do you think people at some of the bigger schools started seeing there are these huge festivals happening all over the world? This is for real? Or what gives?
I think it was a combination of that and simply the pandemic. I mean, COVID shut down sports for, you know, half a year. And I think the ability to be able to still engage with a student body and, you know, have your brand out there as a university, esports was a vital, you know, tool for that. And even though play slowed down during the summertime, as it usually does for all collegiate sports, I think it was a good way for a lot of those larger schools to still sort of stay relevant. Because as you said, the smaller schools are really who are, you know, going out there and winning the big tournaments. A school like Maryville or Harrisburg University, these are two really medium-sized and small-sized universities that usually would be no parts of a athletic conversation, but dominate the esports world. So a lot of the big schools are playing catch up to the smaller schools when it comes to esports.
Western Michigan in Kalamazoo, where Scott's coming to us right now, has a program that's been around for a while. Eastern got its program up and running a few years ago. And now here we are in this time when the University of Michigan has announced its own competitive program. I mean, I was shocked to hear that this might have some branding implications for universities, Norris. But to what extent has it been student-led? I mean, how long have people in some of these programs been advocating?
I mean, to be perfectly honest with you, esports essentially is born on college campuses. I mean, if you go back, you know, to the old arcade days, and almost all of us who have gone to college in the past 20 years know that there was a group of kids who, you know, went to the student union or a student center or certain dorm rooms, and people played video games, whether it was, you know, Call of Duty or Street Fighter or any of those games. And so the energy behind a lot of these programs and a lot of these teams have grown out of student organization. Almost all esports varsity teams began as student organizations or clubs. And so, you know, the big push right now is to get those clubs to move into the varsity point where they could get funding from the university, they could have faculty support, and they could start raising some money in order to be competitive with some of these programs that have already gone all in.
You know, the first thing that came to my mind when I heard that more of the bigger schools were getting involved is just, okay, so players don't necessarily need to be in college to play games. You know, they can even make a pretty good living for themselves if they can get attention on Twitch. What is the benefit to playing esports at the collegiate level?
You know, as it goes with traditional sports, not every kid will make it pro. Not every kid necessarily has the desire to be a professional gamer. But if you have the ability to pay for your education at a school like the University of Michigan or, you know, Akron or Ohio State or any of these other schools, of course, it's an avenue that I think many kids would take. I mean, and it's also a way to justify your gaming habit to your parents. I mean, if you go to mom and dad and say, hey, U of M offered me a $50,000 scholarship, I mean, who's going to say no to that?
Scott, do you think there are any other pieces to this for the gamers themselves?
Yeah, I mean, I think exactly what Nora said, you know, it's you find other avenues, and maybe you might be a good player, good enough to get a scholarship at the University of Michigan, and then you learn from great players and that boosts you to pro. I think that's an amazing opportunity. Or as you're getting that education, as we're seeing a lot of schools are developing academic programs around esports, you start to say, well, I want to be a broadcaster, or I want to be in the next video game developer and make the next video game. Or sports medicine is becoming huge in esports. And so you become,
wait, you need to unpack that for me. Is it the worst of all carpal tunnel syndrome possibilities?
Yeah, a carpal tunnel, eye strain, headaches, back pain, posture. I mean, it's amazing at the sports med. You don't think about sports med and esports, but it's huge.
Yeah. And just to piggyback on that, you know, the University of California, Irvine has a full-time sports psychologist on staff for their esports team. And so you have a lot of kids who are, you know, moving to Southern California away from their family, away from their friends. A lot of them are international students. And, you know, that has a effect on your psyche. And then you have your normal studies compounded with having to play at a high level. And so Scott's absolutely right. You know, a lot of these kids are finding avenues outside of the field of play or the particular game that they're really enjoying with esports. The marketing people, the branding people, there's a lot of behind the scenes stuff, networking folks and architecture like Scott himself. So a lot of the kids are discovering that as they have their journey through collegiate esports. And I think it's amazing. I think it's one of the best things to happen to college campuses in a long time.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Norris Howard. He's the host of the podcast Checkpoint XP and writes about esports content for Beasley Media. We also have Scott Schroeder with us. He's director of visualization at Perkins Will, a sports architecture firm that has been working with a lot of schools to beef up their infrastructure for esports. Norris, given how the NCAA has treated traditional athletes, should there be some trepidation about joining college teams?
You know, that's one of the most interesting sort of developments as we move forward and this thing begins to grow. Then I think the NCAA's reputation or notoriety, so to say, when it comes to student athletes has led to esports wholly rejecting the notion that NCAA should be involved at all. Right now, there is a litany of other organizations such as NACE, TESPA, a lot of third-party organizations that have loose affiliations with game developers that are running these tournaments that schools participate in. And the thing that I think is interesting about this is the fact that there really isn't any limits as to what a student athlete can do in terms of esports. They can flow between, you know, games freely. If they decide that they want to go pro, they have the ability to do so. They just can't play for scholarship money. It's just one of those things where it almost feels as if the player themselves are a lot more empowered to control their own destiny, as opposed to a lot of other student athletes in traditional sports who, as we see now, are just now lobbying and getting some traction on the ability to even monetize their own names.
Can we talk about the Pistons GT for just a second?
Of course.
How are the esports pro teams for the NBA and the NFL doing right now? Can you give us a sort of a check-in at this point?
It's interesting to see the development of the esports versions of real sports, because as it stands right now, while they are maintaining some popularity, they are still dwarfed by Dota 2, League of Legends, Counter-Strike, and other larger esports. And I think traditional sports has a real issue on their hands, because that was supposed to be the way that they capture Gen Z. But the problem is that to play these games, you have to almost have a context and an affiliation for the traditional sport.
Right.
And as traditional sports begins to lose viewership with Gen Z and younger, they have a real problem with getting people involved with these games as well. And so I think they have to do a lot more in terms of highlighting some of the star players that participate in these esports tournaments for the esports. I think they have to do a lot more just really boosting the overall status of these particular tournaments. I think other esports have done a much better job at that.
Scott, what does it take to get a pro team up and running at a school? What kind of facilities are we talking about?
A lot of the schools that we have seen, the facilities that usually are used are the older arcades, pool rooms. They're underutilized spaces that are converted essentially into their esports area. And realistically, most of these spaces have enough power to power the computers. What really needs to be looked at in the school perspective when you're re-kitting these spaces is your networking. Your esports program will live and die by your internet and the network within the building. You know, if you're at a football game and the internet goes out, you can still watch the football, but maybe you can't tweet about the great play.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're playing Dota and the internet goes out,
you're done.
That's it.
Yeah.
I mean, the game's done. So the network is practically the most important piece of a program that no one will ever see, because it's going to be buried in the floor, buried in the wall, but it is the absolute lifeblood of any program.
I mean, the colleges that are involved in this on that level, I mean, would they have those kinds of problems? Have you ever seen that happen where it's in the middle of competition and all of a sudden the lights just go out?
I haven't seen it at the collegiate level, but the Overwatch League, while they were playing from home this year, has had some high-profile players drop out due to random internet issues.
Oh,
so it can definitely happen.
That sounds awful. The culture for every game is a little bit different. Tell us a little bit about some of the emerging groups that maybe had not even been served quite so much by traditional gaming before that are sort of finding their own in this environment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I alluded to it earlier. You have Gen Z, which is heavy into, you know, streaming, and mm-hmm. then vicariously is beginning to get exposed to more and more esports. I think that's one of the major, major cohorts that you see, is that esports skews so young, both in the players and in the viewership. But the viewership for esports is starting to get older. And what you're seeing is a lot of kids introducing their older siblings and parents to esports. And so that's an emerging cohort that you see. I think the Overwatch League for season one and two really tried their best to sort of make the viewing experience as close to a traditional viewing experience for, say, the NFL as they possibly could. Obviously, COVID-19 put a halt on a lot of what they were building, but they were doing home stands. It was a home and away style format where teams were traveling, people were going to a physical location to watch these games, fan experiences. It was actually really, really amazing to see that stuff happening. And another demographic that you're starting to see, especially in the streamer and the esports space, that they still need to do a lot of work on this, but a large percentage of gamers are women. And you're seeing more of an effort, and in my opinion, still not enough, but you're seeing more of an effort to reach out to female gamers and get them more involved at a competitive level as well as a viewership level, because there's no physical limitations to esports. So you really don't need to separate on the basis of gender in esports.
Isn't that more true overseas, though, than it is in the United States, that women are taking up are taking a more of a position in the world?
Absolutely. It is definitely true in Europe. You're seeing it also in Asia as well. And one of the big things that you're seeing is a lot of women are taking roles behind the scenes, but they're not necessarily getting the same representation on the field of play. And so there's moves worldwide to try to change that, but you are correct. I mean, I think Europe and Asia are both leaps and bounds ahead of North America in this respect.
To your point, Norris, while it's certainly true that esports is something that many, many people watch and participate in at home, I have been in rooms where, you know, a bunch of people were getting together, you know, at a software developer's offices or, you know, some sort of social club environment in a bar to watch. And it's just like the energy in the rooms is really hard to describe unless you're talking about like double overtime in an NBA final. And here we are now with COVID just having taken a lot of steam out of that. Do you think that even though COVID is giving, you know, it has been a bit of a moment in terms of recruitment, do you think that it will be very long after the pandemic before we see that social experience with esports come back again?
Yeah, it'll be back for sure. And you know, as somebody who is helping putting these facilities together, I hope that Sad also has strong feelings on this, but I think it'll be back, and I think it'll be back strong. League of Legends right now, their world championships taking place in Shanghai. Obviously, they can't have big crowds, but this is something that drew 100 million viewers worldwide, as well as will pack 90,000 seat stadiums across the world for the grand finals. And so this is something that people already have been doing. I don't think 1 year will change the energy behind that. And I think in North America, you'll begin to see more energy behind it because gaming and streaming and all of it grew by quite a bit. And I think people now have discovered new communities that they want to be a part of. And next year, I can only hope and assume that these developers will be trying to leverage that.
Scott, how about you? Are you looking forward to getting back in a room with several thousand people to be able to watch competition?
Oh, absolutely. I miss the energy. I miss live. I miss high-fiving somebody when something cool happens. I'm absolutely looking forward to getting back in person.
Scott Schroeder is director of visualization at Perkins Will, a sports architecture firm. He works out of Kalamazoo. We've also been speaking with Norris Howard, who writes about collegiate esports at Beasley Media. He also hosts the podcast Checkpoint XP. Scott, Norris, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.